everybody, and welcome to the very 221st episode of the Shut Up and Sit Down podcast, a podcast about board games. Today on the podcast, I'm joined by Ava Foxfort.
I thought that was one too many board games, but that wouldn't really apply to anyone who's coming into my house and looking at my board game collection. They would think, no, that is several times too many board games.
Your house is for the people who like board games, 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 and a person who loves board games.
Yeah, no, I have quite a small house, and like I think only 25% of it is filled with board games, but like that's quite a lot.
That's quite a big number, yeah.
It's a big number.
I think the problem that I have is that my board games aren't contained in a way that is sensible or useful or helpful to anyone. Like, at the moment, the sort of plan was to have it so that all the board games that were sort of in my collection were in a big shelving unit. Mm-hmm. And then all the board games that were sort of coming in to Shut Up and Sit Down for appraisal were going to be in like a cupboard. But now the cupboard is sort of spilling out onto the floor. There's sort of a second pile on the floor in that room. There's another pile about games that are getting filmed. There's another pile of games that are leaving the collection. So they're sort of like just everywhere you sort of open a cupboard or a door or look at a floor, there's probably a board game. You know how like in New York you're meant to always be like, you know, a meter away from a rat or something.
You're definitely always within a meter of a board game in my house.
Exactly,
like definitely, right.
Yeah, I think I've spaced them, so that's very true in this flat as well.
Yeah, I realized that we're not actually going to be sounding relatable to the average person who like doesn't have hordes of like mediocre board games poured through their door every day, but it is more annoying than you think, people at home who don't have any sympathy for us right now. I can't use my corridor properly because like the stuff that we've got that I need to look at again in one way or another is just huge. I've had to like put some more in my board I put loads in my spare room, and like they're the ones that are like from my old collection that I want to get rid of, like ones that I'm actually just trying to like give to people who come here, because it's like these are all actually good games. I can't even shift them. Everyone thinks I'm joking when I say, look, please take my games, I'm dying.
I think the thing people don't realize is that doing this job does give you a really quite venomous and spiteful relationship to the postman. Like, we had a really big shipment of board games come here recently, and I only live on the first floor, but one flight of stairs with that many board games in his hand was clearly like enough for this poor man, and I do feel a bit bad about that.
Tom, right, when I moved house, like not to this place but to a different place, I moved like across town and I moved to a new place, and the first time I answered the door to my new postman, someone who I had, this is important to note, never met before, he saw me open the door and just said, oh no, do I have you now? Because his round was that house, and I had a reputation in the local post office.
No.
A reputation as the person who gets too many boxes.
Oh. There's got to be like a really specific German word for that exact kind of shame.
I worked really hard while I was living at that house on making that postie feel appreciated. And like, he was one of the grumpiest Yorkshiremen I have ever met in my life. Like real constantly holding on to a grudge. And like by the end of it, like after about 2-3 years of living in that house, like we were on good terms, and he said, I hope you have a good time in your new place, in a really like supportive manner that was really kind. So, you know.
But really, do you think there was a little bit of that behind him going like, yes? He was like, thank God.
No, by this time we'd worked out a system, so there was a key hidden for him. So actually he didn't even come to the door that much anymore, because he would mostly just put things in our shed. He was generally a bit put out if anyone did actually answer the door, because it was just simpler to reach behind and like get the shed. Anyway.
Just pop him in the shed.
Yeah.
A really lo-fi kind of receptionist, essentially, there that you've got going on. A post room. Anyway, this intro has got very out of whack, add a line.
It was
track.
All about board games. Like, to be honest, all about board games. In terms of us going off track, I think that is the most about board games that we've made an intro ever.
That's the most on track, off track intro we've ever done. On this podcast, we are going to tell you about three board games that we've been playing recently. Ava is going to tell you about Gizmos, a game of what I can see as trying not to put a load of marbles into your mouth, because there's a lot of, you know, really tasty looking marbles.
Those marbles are really tasty.
I'm going to tell you about Rolling Heights, a game about trying to avoid putting meeples in your mouth, because those meeples, delicious. And then both of us are going to talk about Hamlet, a board game about making a village. I didn't know how I could sort of put a sort of mouthfeel theme in there, but I couldn't.
It's a game about eating countryside.
Yeah, as much countryside as you can fit into your gob. Try and consume as much of it as possible. Yeah, thank you. That's very good. Let's do some games.
Yeah!
Ava, you've been playing a whole bunch of Gizmos recently, right?
I have been playing so much Gizmos. It's kind of alarming how much Gizmos I've played. I found this on Board Game Arena, so it's one of those things where I kind of cheated and have played lots and lots and lots of it. But I did then go out and spend my own real monies on Gizmos because it is really, really cute, really, really sharp, really, really pointy, and I like it.
Tell me more.
Why should I need to tell you more? I think I've just given you everything you need to know. Gizmos is a game by Phil Walker-Harding, who is like one of the most like inconsistently brilliant board game designers on the scene. Like, I think he is really, really sharp and precise, but like some of his things just don't land at all. And like, that's a bit of a harsh thing to say, but like when he is good, he is absolutely the best. He designed Bear Park, which is brilliant. He designed Silver and Gold, which is really quite clever. He designed, I can't actually remember the other things he designed. Tom, what's your favourite Phil Walker Harding?
It's Bear Park, unfortunately.
It's still Bear Park, isn't it?
It's still Bear Park. That game is really good. He designed Imhotep.
Oh, Imhotep is actually one of like my all-time favourites. And I think it's the sharpest design. Like, if you want to look at like efficiency in a board game and everything working towards one purpose, which is being really annoying to your friends, Imhotep, way to go.
I just went to go and have a look on Phil Walker Harding's BGG page, and I saw at the bottom, of course, how could we forget, he designed Sushi Go, which you know, always a classic of the board game store. But at the top on his some notable games list is Tetris. Designed in 2021, apparently.
He was one of the people that stole Tetris from the Soviet Union in 2021? Was that the plot of Red Alert 5? Going back on track and putting various Command and Conquer issues aside, Phil Walker-Harding has designed a game called Gizmos, and I have put off playing it for a really long time, and I am really, really beating myself about. I have to apologize to about 20 different people in forums, comment threads, Twitter, like everywhere that I could possibly find someone to talk about games, telling us over and over again when we were talking about Wingspan, have you tried Gizmos? Everyone said, have you tried Gizmos? Tom, Wingspan is rubbish Gizmos.
Whoa, that's huge. And air horn sound effect in the background there.
And I'm the person that really likes Wingspan on the team, right? Relatively speaking, I'm the biggest fan. Gizmos is an engine builder about converting marbles into points over the course of the game. You do this by collecting the titular gizmos, which will upgrade an action or your abilities to mean that you can, when something happens, it might trigger an extra action. And this whole game is built out of just being like, right, okay, I'm going to get this machine, which means that every time I pick a yellow thing from the conveyor belt, I go bop. And then I get to take a random one from inside the machine, like I'm the claw from Toy Story 2, I think.
By the machine here, it's sort of like a big, it looks like one of those like grabber machines almost, but without the grabber. It sort of looks like a glass box that's full of marbles, except you can't see the marbles.
Yeah, yeah. It's got some marbles like drawn on the outside to delude you into thinking that you can see the marbles, but actually you just have to reach in and be the claw yourself. So
yes, that makes more sense.
First of all, yeah, this is the thing that I should have led with, really. It's got lovely table presence because there's a big device in the middle of the table. In front of that, mm-hmm. you've got this pyramid of cards of increasingly complicated gizmos that are just laid out as a constantly served menu of things that you can take. Now, the actions you can take on the turn are really quite simple. You can build a machine, if you've got enough marbles to pay for it, or energy, or I can't remember what it actually calls them, but there's like four flavors of marble that you can get. Don't eat marbles, by the way. So you've got these gizmos and they are paid for in marbles of a particular color. So building them is as simple as taking them from the middle, putting it in your thing, paying the marbles back into the big machine in the middle that will be spewing out marbles for the entire game.
Simple.
Yeah. You can also pick one color, one marble of one color, directly out of the little conveyor belt that comes out of the machine. Now, this is nice because this is like a randomized sample of what you're going to have access to. And the whole reason for this machine is basically so that you can, there's four or five that are available immediately, and you can just look up the spout a little bit to see what's coming next. So you've just got slightly more information about what's going to be next, just in case you can do a nice cascade with them. And finally, you have this action called file, and that is about taking a card from the middle and saving it for later. It doesn't cost you anything apart from your turn, but you have to put that card in your archive, which at the beginning only has one slot in it. The final action is actually built up of those actions, and it's called research. And it's you draw from the deck, take a couple of cards, have a look at them, and you can either build it straight away if you've got something that you can build, or you can archive one if you've got space to archive into, or you just have to put them all back to the bottom of the deck.
Right.
Right. So that's simple. And at the beginning of the game, it is. You start off with one single gizmo, and this gizmo will mean that the first time you archive a card, put a card into your archive using a file action, you will get to draw one random marble from in the top of the machine. The machine, the dispenser. So you tend to do that first, and then you've got a random marble. Maybe it matches the thing that you just decided to archive. Maybe it doesn't. And then everything that you're building from then on is going to make this stuff more complicated, more fiddly, more weird. First of all, you can make your archive bigger, or you can make the pool of marbles that you're allowed to keep in storage at one time bigger, or you can make it so you can research more cards whenever you do that, mitigating the randomness of that action. Then there's a stack of converters. That means you could turn one yellow one into two yellow ones, or you could turn a black one into any color you like. So you start making yourself like more versatile and more able to do different things. But the real excitement comes from adding things to each of these actions. You can make it so that every time you research, you get to pick a color of your choice. So you get to decide what you're going to do and then know that there's going to be a color waiting for you next time. Or you might do that, but also have something that means that every time you pick a particular color, you then get a random one. Or you do something that every time you build a machine of a certain color, it lets you pick something, and then that lets you pick one of a random color, and then that lets you, and you get these combos and chains building up, and they are so sharp. They are so simple. Like, this is the thing that I think is interesting here, and I think this is one of the things that Phil Walker Harding is particularly good at. All of the things here are simple enough that you probably understand what the machine does just from looking at the icons.
Yeah.
Once you've been playing for half a game, you kind of understand everything that's possible in the game in theory. But every game you'll have a different option for things, so different machines will work better. And they tie together so much that you've always got this like, oh God, I just imagine how big this thing would be if I could get this and this and this and this. And then something doesn't show up, or you don't switch your tactics at the right time, and it's all over. It all goes over so, so quickly. The aim of the game is to get points. All of the machines are worth points. The high-level machines might get you extra points for having a particular thing, or might just get you lots of points and a really powerful action. But the game is over once you've built 16 gizmos, or I think it's four of the high-level gizmos.
Right.
And that is not enough, but only just. It's that thing of when you win the game, it's because you maybe got to operate the ultimate version of your machine once. right?
Right.
The rest of the time, you're just getting those little bits of efficiency, those little bonuses, those little calculations of like, is it worth taking that and building it now? Knowing that like, if I got that first, it would be better to do that. And oh, it's this, it's a really, all of this probably sounds really like, I don't understand why Ava's so excited. I've seen this game a lot of times.
Yes.
Is that a fair assessment? A little bit?
A little bit.
A little
bit. It sounds like a very satisfying engine builder. Yep. What's the secret sauce?
The secret sauce is that they have, it has just sloughed off anything unnecessary to that process. This is the simplest engine builder I've ever seen with the most variety within what you can create. Mm-hmm, like, mm-hmm. When people were making those comparisons to Wingspan, I think there was a thing of like, there is so much missing from this in comparison to Wingspan in terms of like, oh, you don't have the birds, like you don't get to, there's not such a huge variety of items, that there's this big box full of cards that are all the varied possibilities that you can have, and all of these options that trigger in different ways and different exciting things. You don't have all of that, but this game has essentially all of its rules explained on the components that are in front of you. Right, teaching this is a dream. Yes. Because the bar that says what your actions are and says where you're going to file your cards actually explains like 80% of the rules for you. Like, if someone has already played this, everyone at the table is going to be able to learn it really quickly. Everyone is going to get into it really quickly. Everyone is going to see quite quickly that there's like a lot of options on display. And it is still interesting to me, as someone who thought that I was going to get bored of this quite quickly because I thought there isn't enough variety here. I think I've played about 20, 30 games on Board Game Arena in the last month and a half. And
wow.
That is a lot. And I'm still excited by it. I'm still excited to talk about it. I played my first game of it in person. I was a bit disappointed that the marbles aren't as colorblind friendly as I would have hoped, considering they're kind of like double coded on the cards. But, you know, they've tried a little bit. But yeah, it's really quite good.
I really like what you said earlier about the idea of it being an engine building game where your engine fires maybe once.
Yeah.
And you don't get to like churn out shed loads of like points of rounds where you just fire your machine over and over again. It's sort of like you're building more like a Rube Goldberg machine, is it?
Oh,
where it's like,
yeah.
You have that final cascade where everything finally sockets into place. You get that satisfying reveal. And then it's over. And I love that because I always think like, I keep going back to it as a game that really had this problem. But Boon Lake by Alexander Pfister was a game that I played a while ago, which is very much on the opposite end of the spectrum in terms of complexity here. Boon Lake is big, crunchy, complicated. But that was a game where you felt like you got your engine to operate at its peak for like maybe 6 or 7 rounds too many. And it just felt like you had these very like strange final turns where you just went, I get like 50 points again. And then your opponent takes their turn. Mm. And then you go, I get 54 points this time. And then it happens again. And so I'm glad to hear that like Gizmos is a game that kind of slams shut when it needs to.
Yeah. And honestly, it slams shut so sharp that I think that to some extent, it's an engine building game that is also possibly like 50% a push your luck game.
Right.
Because I think that there is an extent to which how elaborate you decide to make your machine. Like, you aren't really just making one machine. Each of these things can be independent of each other and can socket into different kind of things and different kind of actions. Every turn, you are deciding whether you're going to make that machine more complicated or whether... Are you going to just like have a turn where you save up for precisely what you want instead of taking a random chance that you get something better, right?
Mm.
And those efficiencies are what are going to win or lose you the game. Like whether you're willing to dig into the research and whether you get the right cards. Now, this is frustrating, but the game is quick enough that it doesn't matter and it feels like you can just like jump straight into another game or just be annoyed and frustrated with it. And I think that is nice. Also, I kind of like emphasize that frustration, but I think that's a lot more present on playing it online where you can see the scores really clearly as you're going through it.
Yeah.
And it's like when you see that, you realize that actually once you've fallen like more than 5 points behind, if you haven't got a machine that's just about to go bam, 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 then mm-hmm. you've probably lost and you kind of know that.
Mm.
And sometimes there's ways to claw your way back in and sometimes the other person is unlucky and you're lucky. But yeah, that's rarer. But like played at a table, you've got no idea. You've got no idea what other people have got. And it's just Yeah, it's just really neat.
Ava, I've had enough of your gizmos.
That's fair.
It's time for me to tell you about Rolling Heights. This is a game designed by John D. Clare and published by AEG. And I'm going to get straight to the big gimmick here. It doesn't make sense to even avoid it. We're just going to get right into the muck. The muck is, in this game, Ava, you do not roll dice. You roll meeples. That's right. The standard board game guy is getting thrown around inside of a little box for your pleasure in Rolling Heights, the Rolling Meeples game. What are your immediate thoughts on this matter?
I'm picturing whether I can read a meeple and where it's standing from a distance and whether they don't just all just go one way. And I don't know. I'm a bit annoyed because I'm thinking about Pass the Pigs and I don't want to do that.
It's kind of like Pass the Pigs. You have three possible things that can happen when you roll your meeples in this game. So for a bit of context, in Rolling Heights, you are building a city made of tiny little cubes. And the way that you build that city together against each other, not cooperatively, competitively, is by rolling little meeples inside of a box. These meeples representing your workers who are going to be doing the building in question. So at the start of a turn, the first thing you do is you take a big handful or a small handful at the start of the game of meeples and you throw them into a box. And depending on how they land, they will do a different thing. If they are stood up on their feet in the standard meeple position, they're working hard and they will do their action really well. If they're like on their side in some way, like not flat on their back, but kind of like doing a little handstand or doing sort of halfway through a cartwheel, they're like sort of working. They'll do their action, but they won't do it very well. And if they're flat on their back, they are literally tired. They are so sleepy and they're having a nap. They will do nothing. In that circumstance, they're on holiday, they're on break, they're not going to do anything for you. So a way this might be represented is one of the blue meeples gets your steel that you use to build buildings. If you roll a meeple and he's standing on his legs, you're going to get two steel. If he's on his side, you're going to get one steel. If he's lying on his back, you're going to get nothing. And that gimmick is sort of the same within all of the different meeples. They'll do a thing real good, kind of good, and badly. However, Rolling Heights is also kind of a push-your-luck game, because once you roll your workforce of, let's say, 10 meeples, you can keep re-rolling ones that are lying down for free until at least half of your meeples are somewhat standing, at which point you may then take the meeples who are lying down, and you can roll them again, but if you ever do a full roll and everyone is lying down, your workers go on strike because you're working them too hard and you have to get rid of half of your existing standing or half working meeples. Does that make sense?
I mean, yes and no. Like, that makes sense as a game system. I don't know. I don't think I can be quite that cynical quite so quickly. But yes, I understand what you have just said.
So once you've finished rolling your workers, you're then going to use them to build buildings. So all that steel you got from rolling your meeples, all the wood you got from rolling your meeples, all the resources you gathered, you get them in a big pile and you can pay any combination of resources to buy tiles, which are kind of in a market around the edge of the board. And then you put those tiles onto the board to sort of act as foundations for buildings. And then you can put the specific resources on top of those foundations or blueprints. So a building might have like a requirement that it needs a tower of 4 steel. And you just rolled for some blue meeples and got 4 steel. So you can build a little tower, put a little hat on it, and that'll score you some points. But it'll also bag you even more meeples. You might get meeples that make your other meeples work harder. So when they are standing up, they can make someone else stand up too. You can get meeples that'll just score you points. You can get meeples that'll get you money, which is the thing you can just use to buy any tile, you know, sort of, quote, for free, rather than for other resources you could use to build them. And you have meeples that will, like, conditionally score you points. So I had one that would only score me points if I had another one standing or something like that. And so you're building these buildings on a big central board that builds up and looks really charming over time, because you've got these tiny little resource cubes that stack into big skyscrapers made of steel, or little apartment blocks made of what looks like wood, but I think is meant to be brick, and tiny little houses where you've got, like, you know, rather than having one big tower you need to make, you just have a few little plots that you need to pepper some wood around. And what the game has is this kind of slightly weird and hypnotic rhythm that I'm going to describe to you now, and I don't know if you can sort of picture it in your head. This is a game where you are encouraged to start rolling your meeples as soon as you're like finished with your turn. So you can minimize downtime, and so everyone's always doing something. So you start rolling your meeples as soon as the other player starts beginning to do their bits, because you didn't have any way of interacting with them until it gets back to your turn. And so you have this very strange rhythm where there's no player interaction or very little player interaction, and you just sit there and you roll a bunch of meeples into a box, which is quite satisfying. They're a weird thing to roll. And the sort of weird sort of probability that you do in your head of not quite knowing if they are going to like majority stand up or on their side or lie down, it's very interesting. But Matt described this in a sort of, in many ways, but one of the things he said is it's like you're mostly just rolling pleasing little jelly babies in a box. And it's definitely true. It's definitely how it feels, because we sort of got to this point where no one was really speaking that much. They were just rolling, going, yeah, or going, ah. Oh. And then just putting a bunch of resources into little towers on a board. It was so odd.
It's really interesting, isn't it? That like downtime is almost universally seen as being a problem that needs to be fixed, when like actually like when you're not having to concentrate on the game, if you've got enough that you can think about and talk about and you can follow about what other people are doing, that's where a lot of the fun happens.
Right.
Because you get to like watch what people are doing. Like downtime is actually like being the audience for the game, right? Downtime is taking some time to actually like enjoy what is happening at the table. When there's nothing enjoyable happening at the table, that probably is bad. But sometimes that's because you're getting a bit of a break, and that can still be useful. But like the idea that you've got to get it out of there. And on the other hand, this sounds like some kind of weird meeple-based cult. Like I'm just picturing like playing this in a pub and like people walking by and just seeing like a load of people just like shaky, 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 box, clatter, but all of them doing it at the same time, apart from one person who is like, currently I am in charge of this machine. And all of these people around just doing this little, oh, or, yeah, or, oh no. All around them in this like kind of like completely abstract ritual of something. That makes me like the idea of this. A lot of the things you've said so far really don't, but you did kind of make it a little bit of a pitch for it there, because like my first question is, would this not be better if you were just rolling dice and or if this was just Kabuto's?
So no to the first thing, yes to the second.
Yeah.
I think the fact that it's not dice is very interesting and pleasing. Like, it is a gimmick, rolling meeples. Mm. But I think that that weird trying to gauge the probability of it makes it a more exciting push-your-luck prospect. Because you can never really get a handle on exactly how they're going to roll. And you sort of, one of my favorite parts of the game is people kind of coming up with hot new strategies for how to get their meeples to stand up. Like, you know how you can kind of roll dice, you know, when you roll them onto one of those like sunken like poker tables, and it's very satisfying because you roll them in there. Because you get this little box, there's this element of like, I started to try and roll them to like smack them up against a wall because I was like, that'll make him more likely to stand up. And someone was more like rolling, they were sort of dropping them, sort of flicking them almost into the box in a way that didn't look like a standard roll. And everyone had these weird sort of rituals they thought would make it so that their meeples would stand up. I think it's good. I think it's cool and it's weird and they're fun to roll. And I think if this had dice, it would be less entertaining.
Yeah.
However, with the Kubito's comparison, I think like while I was playing that game, while I was playing Rolling Heights, I did want to play Kubito's because it's a push-your-luck game that's got a little bit more edge to it. And I think that it has much more interaction, whereas Rolling Heights very rarely had interactions that felt that substantive. And that's what kind of, you know, feeds into the atmosphere of being a game where everyone kind of does something on their own. And it's definitely one of those games where you sort of just, someone says, right, I'm going to do this and this and this and this. And you just trust them because they've got a little box and they're rolling meeples in it and you don't know what's going on. And that's just fine. I think my biggest frustration with it is that I think it's a pleasant game. I had a pleasant time playing it. I think it just went on a little bit too long, and I wish it was a bit smaller and a little bit faster, because by the end of it, kind of similar to Gizmo's, we had a loop that was a little bit tired. Like, I had sort of caused this for myself, but I ended up being in a point where I had a bunch of meeples that were just, I was rolling them and just scoring points. Mm-hmm. And so the end of the game for me was just rolling gobs of meeples and going, I get 20 points, and then it being the next person's go, and then me just sat there watching three people roll meeples in a box and go, ugh. But yeah. I don't think anyone was particularly loving the end game of it, because once you've got your engine to fire, you don't need it to fire like a million times to know that it works.
Okay. Okay, I think there's something interesting there, because I think that feels like that's almost a proof of concept for a thing that, like, this weird ritual of rolling meeples around a circle. I, like, it's really hard. It's really hard, Tom, because, but, like, I do feel that I really enjoy how you're describing the vibe of sitting there and playing this game, but everything you said about the game has felt a little bit meh. Because there's something I'm interested in the fact that you said that you were going to go like trying to roll and doing rituals to try and make things land properly. Because one of my next questions was going to be like, is it a dexterity game? Right? Because I would actually be more into a version of this where like you got to like throw your meeples at a distance and get them to land somewhere. Right? Like you're not allowed to have the box too close to you, but you're throwing it in like... I think that could be hilarious, especially if like if it lands in someone else's box, they've just like taken your workers. Yes. I think that there's fun to be had in something like that, but possibly not the most interesting thing. But yeah, you haven't sold me on this, but I've been won around and I'm kind of disappointed I didn't launch into my tirade of all of the reasons why I thought that sounded like a terrible idea. Because yeah, if there is like fudging probabilities... is really, really useful in game design. Making it so that someone can't come along and just say, oh no, there's no point in rolling now because the odds are it's not going to come out how you want. Like, a lot of people want that because that's how you make decisions that are meaningful. But at the end of the day, rolling dice is rolling dice. And like, you can't get annoyed at a meeple for just lying down because that wasn't the most likely thing, because you have no idea whether that was the most likely thing or not. Maybe. Yes.
And that's the part of the game that I think is the strongest. Yeah. And I sort of wish that the gimmick of rolling meeples was kind of attached to a more satisfying game on top of it. I think there is something really cool there and I want to see it improve, because I found the sort of quite boggy and sort of standard Euro game of rolling heights is nowhere near as fun as the silliness of rolling big fistfuls of meeples into a little box.
Yeah. No, I think I'm interested in it. I think it's one of the things where the next thing that John D. Clare or someone else does with that sort of mechanic, I might be really up for getting excited by, because I think that,
same here.
That there's vibes there that could be interesting. So I'm gonna stick it on the one to watch list. Although I should note that the other watch list has gone in is the one where I want to have a big think about what this says about labor markets and the interactions with workers within those markets, because I think there's just something a bit... I'm very suspicious of this idea of like, oh yeah, you know how workers are, like you just show up in the morning and they're either like really efficient or crap, and if they're crap you've just got to keep on rolling them until they don't, like, and hope that they don't strike, and
until it's like, they do some bloody work.
I didn't like the vibes there. The anarchist, the communist, the activist, the unionist in me did not like feel very good about that.
I do think there's a nice aspect to it where the fact that if you take a big fistful of workers who have worked too hard and roll them again, they go on strike and it's your fault because you're being a bully, and that's good. I like that. I think that's strong. It's like you know that picking up a handful of three workers who really shouldn't be working and rolling them in a box, and then they go, nah, mate, we're not doing this anymore. And then half of your workers who are working join the ones who aren't. I like that. And that's a good little touch.
Oh, I enjoy that there's actually like there's a worker solidarity moment there at the end where it's exactly. Like, nope, you, that is too much. That is not okay. Unionize, folks. So you may have seen that up on the Shut Up and Sit Down YouTube channel, the YouTube channel that is owned by us, the Shut Up and Sit Down podcast, there was a video and I was in it. I mean, I was sort of over it. This was a script that I wrote a while back about a game that I've really been wanting to talk about for a long time, and couldn't quite figure out the format, but we've been experimenting with making like what I've been thinking of is like a kind of video podcast, where it's like one of the cozy podcast things only and video, about a game that I really liked that is called Hamlet. It's not, sadly, Hamlet 2, the sequel to the Danish Prince monstrosity that we've been waiting for literally like 400 years. It's just a game about building a village. And I made a video about my village, sort of, and how the landscape shaped it. Because the thing that you will notice about Hamlet First is that it is a game about building stuff where the tiles that you are laying in the middle of the table are just really unusual shapes. There's a lot of weird shapes. It's all little triangles and octagons and like weird things with dangly bits, and they all slot together in according to these rules. Now, this is what I would call the lightest possible version of that splotter game thing where everyone has to build an economy together and you know that anything you do can be stolen by other people. Players in this only control the money that they've got in their pockets and the people that they've got on the board and the donkeys that those people are hanging out with. Everything that's left on the board, the resources, the stone, the wood, the wheat, they are all available to anyone. If you go to the woods and you chop down some trees, you will leave some wood. If you use it at the end of your turn, before the end of your turn, then you've used it. If you've left it, then the next player has the opportunity to just take it for whatever they want. Now, they can only take things that they can reach using their donkeys as a kind of mobile transport system that takes things from place to place. And you have to place your workers into the places where you want to take the action. So if I want to go and use a sawmill to make some planks of wood, I have to go with the worker to a sawmill and then pull wood from wherever the wood has been produced. Then with all of that stuff, just taking a few really simple worker placement style actions, you're trying to race to build the right bits of the church that will turn your hamlet into a town. Apparently, according to the manual, that's the definition of a hamlet. It's a village that's too small to have a church in. So you're trying to end the game by making yourself stop being a hamlet. And that happens when the church gets built. We turned ours into like a community center disco in one of the games that I played because someone there wasn't fond of churches as places. So, yeah. And that just means getting...
You turned it into Boogie Town.
You turned it into Boogie Town. And basically that just is a matter of like being the first to do some really big deliveries where all of the stuff gets transported to somewhere in one go. This is a really simplified version of it, but it's actually quite a simple game wrapped in a complicated set of rules. It might take you a little while to get your head into because a lot of it is unintuitive. And I think that that's led some people to bounce off this a bit. And a lot of this is all of these actions, all of the things that you can do are in the middle of the table in a town that you're all building together and kind of passive aggressively stretching away from each other to kind of encourage people to use your options or build little landscapey bonuses or all sorts of things like that. And this means that everyone is looking in the center of the table the whole time. This is one of the first times where I've played this sort of Euro game that's about worker placement and resource conversion, where everyone was always looking into the middle of the table. Everyone was always thinking about, oh, is that going to be full? Is that still going to be full on my turn? Because if it is, then that means that I can send my person there, like coming up with their routes. And then also the whole point of the video that I made, and this is probably why I like this a little bit disproportionately, is because of those weirdly shaped tiles, this builds like villages that I can relate to and towns that I can relate to, because weirdly shaped tiles, because there's weird landscape and there's people who are like passive aggressively going like, well, actually, I'm going to be the only person who has milk because I'm going to build my dairy at the bottom of that road really, really far away from you. And then you realize that actually there's another dairy card in the board. There's another dairy card in the box and someone takes it and puts it down. And then it's like, oh, why doesn't anyone want my milk? I don't get money until you use it. And yeah, I don't know. It was funny to me.
I really enjoy that slow spreading out of the board across the table, like where different people care about different locations as well. Like there's always that thing in games where you're more inclined to take the pieces that are closest to you or like occupy the territory that's nearest to you on the table. And I think that like when we played Hamlet with three players, we had a very pleasingly triangular village. And how we had all of this sort of strange, like the way that then because of the way that people build things close to them, you have this very strange crisscrossing infrastructure, and the way that the donkeys kind of like light up the ball with this very strange little like route building mechanic is really quite charming. Yeah. And you're right as well that like there's glimmers of that kind of splotter character in there. In our game, one person became sort of known as Milk Boy because their whole thing was just churning out endless amounts of milk for God knows what goal. I think Hamlet it's sweet, and it is sweet. And I think that I really like the vibes of Hamlet. And I'm glad that we got to put a video out about it. And I'm glad that we got to put a video out about it that kind of sort of highlights where it sings and where it's unique and where it's a little bit strange. It's a really pretty little thing.
I think it's really nice. And I think like my main criticism of it is that the pieces are just that bit too small. And so it's really hard to read the board from the other side of the table.
That's true.
And when that's such a huge part of it. Now, the game is actually simple enough that once you've got used to it, you kind of know what everything does anyway. And like the only things that you're likely to forget are things that will be, how do you build this tile? How much does it cost? You're not going to remember that off the top of your head. So you're going to have it in your hand until you put it on the board. And then everyone kind of can guess that the big sawmill over there is the thing that needs wood that will turn it into planks.
Right.
But if that iconography was just a bit bigger and a bit bolder, I think it would be much, much, much more readable. And like, I would get less back pain from like leaning over the table. And that bothers me a bit. I should also probably note that I think almost everyone I have heard talking about this has been a bit more critical of it than me, and I think people have had a bit less of an entertaining time with it. So I'm not saying, like, I definitely love it. I think I might love it for slightly weird reasons. I think it might be like a solid middling Euro game that has some charming ideas. I think it's ever so slightly more than that. I think that there is something unique about a game at that level that has everybody in the middle sort of cooperating to build a town, but also sort of passive aggressively getting in each other's way and finding little ways to be just a little bit spiteful by being like, oh, well, I don't really have to, but I could just use all of this wood here because that means I know you won't be able to build that without going back to there, sending an extra worker. And yeah, building a network of transport out of donkeys and just bouncing things along your donks. And yeah, I found a lot of charm here. And so I don't want to be the one saying this is bad because I don't think it's bad. I think it's a really, really nice game. But I've seen a lot more people bounce off it than I have had my reaction to it.
I'll sort of add to the choir there, where I've only played Hamlet once, and it was a slightly wonky game of it that we played, but I didn't find it, I didn't necessarily feel amped to go back to it. I think it's quite a particular game, and whether you really get on with it or whether you sort of find it just all right, I think does depend on how much you key into that sort of the coziness of it almost, the theme and it is beautiful. Like, it's a very beautiful game, even though the UX kind of suffers a little bit. Because of that, it's a game that if you click with it, you'll really click with it, and if you don't, you won't.
Yeah.
And I think I'm in that latter camp where I enjoyed my time with it, but I'm not rushing to play it again.
Yeah.
I do love the vibes, though. I love the vibes.
Such good vibes in that village. Woo!
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Shut Up and Sit Down podcast. That's all the games we're going to talk about on this episode. We've talked about gizmos, we talked about rolling meeples, and we talked about villages. Those are the three things we talked about on this episode of the Shut Up and Sit Down podcast. I realized that when I said we talked about gizmos, I just said the name of the game. And then the other two, I didn't say the name of the game. Rolling Heights isn't called Rolling Meeples, and Hamlet isn't called Villages. It's called Hamlet. Very confusing.
I didn't notice that you'd got Rolling Heights wrong and just thought you got Hamlet wrong and was like almost jumping in with like, no, it's called Hamlet. Please watch my video, please. Thanks.
I'm not good at my job. You heard it here first. Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll see you again next week. For both of us again, I think. Talk about more games.
Yeah, games.
Oh, I gotta love them. Bye.
Bye.